morning. May it please the court. I'm Travis Gunn.
Wait just one second.
I'm sorry?
Wait.
I apologize.
The courtroom is full enough to hear your argument.
I'm honored.
You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Travis Gunn of Guara Woods, here on behalf of petitioner Daryl Jackson. With me at counsel's table is Virginia Price. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal. We're here today on Daryl's habeas petition seeking relief for ineffective assistance of counsel. As the court is aware, ineffective assistance claims are a two-step analysis. First, whether counsel provided constitutionally deficient representation, and second, whether that deficient representation prejudiced the petitioner. In this case, the answer to both of those questions is yes. First, the deficient representation. Daryl was charged with 4 counts. There was robbery, conspiracy to commit that robbery, use of a firearm during the commission of the robbery, which was the 53.1 charge, and then possession of a firearm by a convicted felon, which was the 308.2 charge. Daryl's criminal trial was segmented into 2 phases, and during the first phase, the jury heard evidence on those first 3 charges, robbery, conspiracy, and the 53.1 use charge. And the jury found Daryl guilty on all 3 charges. The parties then moved right into the second phase of trial with the same jury on the 308.2 possession charge. And after the evidence had been submitted to the jury and the jury was excused from the courtroom, that is when Daryl's counsel provided deficient representation. And that is because at that point in time, Daryl's counsel did move to strike the evidence, but he failed to do so on the basis that the evidence was not sufficient to prove a 308.2 firearm. Reading the transcript and the record in this case, it is apparent that counsel's deficiency originated from his confusion over a 53.1 use firearm and a 308.2 possession firearm, and he conflated those statutes. But the General Assembly enacted those 2 different statutes to reach 2 different types of conduct, and it has actually enacted 2 different statutory schemes punishing those conduct. And this court has reflected the General Assembly's intent in enacting these 2 different statutes by defining the term firearm as used in those different statutes differently. And it is that case law that would have formed the basis for counsel filing a motion moving to strike on the basis of insufficient evidence to prove a 308.2 firearm. And that case law would have given that motion some weight. It would have carried some weight, would have had some substance.
Counsel, is a consequence of your argument that you would have to either have the actual firearm or it would have to be discharged in order to prove that this was a quote-unquote firearm?
Certainly not, Your Honor, and that rolls right into the prejudicial analysis of...
And they really are hand in glove in this case, because if there's no prejudice, no, you know, and so on.
Yes, Your Honor. Unlike other habeas matters and the failure to make a motion to strike, it really just rolls right together. It's essentially, at the end of the day, is there a reasonable probability that the trial court would have granted that motion? And to respond to your question, the answer is no.
Okay.
The burden would not be for the Commonwealth to actually find this gun or to have a witness testifying that the firearm was discharged. What is required under this court's case law and the Court of Appeals case law is any evidence beyond mere witness description of the object. And that evidence can even come from the defendant himself.
But didn't he brandish it?
So what all the evidence shows is that the defendant was in possession of an instrument that looked like a firearm.
Right.
There is no suggestion in the evidence that the witness did anything other than have it in his possession. There was no testimony of him pointing the firearm. There is no evidence that he was threatening anyone with any verbal communication. And I understand Your Honor's point.
So in other words, if I just tap my gun, I say, hey, empty the register, no conviction, but I point it, that's an implied assertion, I have a functioning firearm, now I can be convicted. I'm just trying, I mean, because there's tons of these cases, and we have to figure out where to draw the line, and that's what I'm struggling with.
Yes, Your Honor, I understand that concern. And I would take I direct Your Honor's attention to this court's cases in Armstrong and in Jordan that recognize that the situation that you are describing where there is a firearm present at a crime is addressed by 53.1. And so that wrongful conduct falls within the scope of 53.1 and gets punished under that statutory scheme. And this court has recognized so that 308.2, the possession firearm, is not merely duplicative of that 53.1 use charge. There needs to be something more than the mere presence of that firearm. And there has to be something more than the witnesses describing that they saw something that they thought was a gun.
Have we gone quite that far? That a witness that says, look, I'm familiar with a Glock 9. That was a Glock 9. It was not a replica. It was not a toy BB gun. I don't know that we've gone so far as to say, as a matter of law, that's not enough. I mean, we have the one case where there's an implied assertion and someone identifies the weapon as a Raven. And the witness says, I know what a Raven is. I mean, come on. It's that. And we said that was enough. So I'm wondering if to win your point in this case, you need to go quite as far as you're going with your argument.
Maybe I misunderstand the court's question.
There's no evidence here that the weapon was brandished.
Correct.
There's no evidence it was pointed at anyone.
Correct, Your Honor.
We don't really know whether or not he even had it out of his waistband for all we know.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So it's altogether possible if he had brandished it, or if he had pointed it, or if he had tapped the counter while he was looking at the guy in the eye, that that would have been plenty sufficient for an implied assertion.
Yes, Your Honor. That is our point, that under Jordan, those facts that you describe would be legally sufficient for the jury to then determine whether it was a 308.2 possession firearm. But those facts don't exist here, which is the point we make in terms of prejudice. That is, because those additional facts beyond the mere presence of the firearm and someone describing that that instrument looked like a gun, there's nothing else in the record here. That is insufficient under Armstrong, which says the element of perception is not part of 308.2. That is not the realm of Jordan, where it was not just identifying the firearm as a Raven, something the victim thought he knew and understood, but it was also the fact that there was that implied insertion of pointing the instrument. And because those facts are absent from this case...
My only point is we didn't hold in that case that the assertion of Raven would not have been enough. We didn't need to hold that. All we said is there was assertion of Raven and there was the implied the statement about Raven and the implied assertion together.
Yes, Your Honor. Part of that holding, however, is affirming Red versus Commonwealth, which was the Court of Appeals case. But in the Court of Appeals case, the court said mere description of the object alone is not sufficient. And there they moved on to
But we didn't say that in our case, because that's the furthest, that's way further than you need to go to win your argument in this case, one. And two, I'm not sure why that would be true. If you know a firearm by looking at it, like that officer over there could look at a firearm and say, look, that's not a BB gun. Why isn't that enough?
Two things, Your Honor. First, I certainly don't want to overextend myself if I can win on a easier argument. I might just be missing the point, so I apologize.
I'm trying to help you not overextend.
Okay. In the...
Don't let him lead you down the path.
Yeah, let me make sure I'm following you correctly. The reason why mere description of the object alone is not sufficient, even from someone who is familiar generally with guns, is because that would erase...
Why would your argument be, even if that's true, we don't have it here? I mean, I think that's the point that Justice Kelsey's trying to make.
All right. Yes, Your Honor. I see it now, and I agree. Yes, Your Honor. That is not this case.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. I apologize for my oversight.
Let me ask you a question about that. We're all trying to figure out the boundaries. That's the issue. If someone came up behind another person and stuck their finger in that victim's back, and it just hypothetically, and said, I want your money or I will shoot you. There is no gun ever recovered. Do I understand your argument that may very well be sufficient for a conviction because of the statements made by the defendant under 53.1, but not under 308.2?
Yes, Your Honor, that is correct. 53.1 has that element of perception where essentially perception alone can satisfy the firearm definition. But that is not the case for 308.2 possession, which is essentially a status offense. As long as you qualify as a certain class of individuals and you actually possess the item.
And, this and the ineffective assistance of counsel here was the failure to identify the distinction between these two.
Yes, Your Honor.
And I guess we could get to prejudice just by looking at the evidence which was in the record and whether or not that would have been a motion to strike that should have been granted.
Yes, Your Honor.
One thing I struggle with is we have circumstantial cases all the time. And so what we ask of our judges and juries is to make reasonable fact-finding based on common sense in part. And so if the vast majority of robberies use real guns, and we have to acknowledge there's a subset of robberies that occur with BB guns or toy guns or replica guns, but that's a fairly common sense suggests a fairly small subset. And someone has a gun and multiple witnesses say it's a gun. Why is it unreasonable? I know we have this crust of precedent that may have in our decision making, but just why is it unreasonable fact-finding to say, look, you're going around waving, or you have a gun, and lots of people see you with a gun. Generally, people don't rob convenience stores with toys. That's a reasonable fact-finding that it was actually a gun.
So I appreciate, I do want to answer your question directly, but I will go to first principles, which is what I understand your question to refer to. But of course, there is that existing case law. To respond to your question, though, as a matter of first principles, goes back to the fact there is already a statute for the situation you're describing, and that is the 53.1 use statute. And the evidence that you are describing reasonably goes to establishing a 53.1 use firearm. But the General Assembly enacted the separate statute, which is not concerned specifically with firearms at a crime. It's concerned with certain classes of individuals possessing a specific item, which are its actual firearms. And it is the Commonwealth's burden in that separate statutory context to prove that it is an actual firearm. And just because that firearm appears at a certain location does not necessarily imply that it is an actual firearm as opposed to some other non-firearm instrument, as Your Honor referred to.
Would you like to save the remainder of your time? You may use your time any way you'd like.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. I will reserve the remainder of my time.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Lauren Campbell on behalf of the Director in this matter. The Court has identified the specific issue in this case is whether if trial counsel had made a motion to strike on the specific grounds that the Commonwealth failed to prove petitioner possessed an instrument which was designed, made, and intended to expel a projectile by means of an explosion, whether the trial court would have granted that motion to strike. And the Director would submit that the answer to that question is no. The trial court would not have granted the motion to strike because it was a factual issue for the jury. In this case, trial counsel did make a motion to strike the firearm, and his basis was that the firearm was never found, the Commonwealth failed to prove a firearm was even involved in the crimes, or that Jackson himself was involved. There is no reasonable probability that if a motion to strike had been made on the grounds in the habeas petition, it would have been granted when three different witnesses, all familiar with the petitioner, unequivocally testified that they saw the defendant possess a gun. Therefore, petitioner has failed to meet his burden under
strict. Do these witnesses have to have familiarity with firearms? So if you have someone who was in the military or a police officer or something who has extensive contact with firearms, is that different than someone who just maybe has seen them on TV and couldn't tell a Franklin Mint replica or a BB gun from an actual firearm?
The director would submit that. Obviously, if a foundation was laid, why someone had knowledge, such as in Jordan, where his knowledge of the Raven was coming from, how he knew, how long he saw, certainly that has more weight to it. but that does not necessarily mean that three witnesses who were familiar with the defendant for different reasons, one being his cousin, one...
But familiarity with the defendant versus familiarity with guns may be a different proposition.
Certainly, Your Honor. The director's position is that they were all in a position to know whether or not Jackson actually possessed a firearm or whether he possessed something that was just a fake or
I mean, did they see him, for instance, rack the slide or load ammunition or, clean it or, something?
Certainly, Your Honor. And that's not in the record of this case. There was not cross-examination going towards questions such as that. However, based on this record and what is in this record, unequivocally, those three witnesses all testified uncontroverted with no cross-examination or objection, unobjected to, that what they saw was a gun. And based on that, that evidence put forth by the Commonwealth made a prima facie case.
But if one witness is not enough to just say, well, it was a gun, without more, then how could the accumulation of similarly vague testimony get you across the finish line? I'm just trying to figure out what the importance of three versus one as opposed to specificity might mean.
Certainly, Your Honor. I would also submit that the co-defendant in this case later was found also in possession of a firearm, which would indicate that he knows what a firearm is if he is also possessing firearms. And again, he unequivocally testified to what the defendant to what Jackson had in his possession, both during the crime and after the crime at his home. This case is obviously a circumstantial case, but the Commonwealth put forward evidence that was the jury was entitled to make the decision in this case. It was not a legal question, and at a motion to strike, it is simply testing the legal sufficiency of the evidence.
So, from the Commonwealth's perspective, a witness who says that was a firearm and perhaps who knows the defendant for whatever that's worth, that's sufficient to survive a motion to strike, and then it's up to the jury to figure out from the totality of the evidence whether they believe the Commonwealth's met its burden of proof or not.
I think, again, it would depend on the record as a whole. If that one witness, just hypothetically, if that one witness had no familiarity with the defendant with any firearms, only saw it very briefly in passing, certainly that could be a different case, but that's not this case.
So one additional factor on your side of the ledger is that they had the opportunity to see the firearm in some detail?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Up close.
I would submit it's simply a totality of the circumstances.
Right.
But they didn't say anything about having seen it in detail, did they?
No, Your Honor, and again, they weren't cross-examined or objected to about their foundation and their base of their knowledge. And the record is what the record is in this case.
Right.
But the prosecutor didn't ask a single question. What kind of handgun was it?
Certainly, Your Honor.
Was it a real gun or was it a Kmart BB gun? It was a real gun. What kind of question is that? I mean, that's all it would have taken here.
Certainly, Your Honor. The co-defendant did give the most description of the firearm in describing it as a black and silver handgun. But that is the most description that appears in the record.
At the presence of the robbery, is there any evidence that the weapon was brandished or pointed to anyone or any even nonverbals that I have a weapon?
No, there was no verbal communication. There's no evidence that it was necessarily brandished. The victim did give testimony that he was hit in the head, but it's unclear whether the victim was not sure whether he saw a firearm or another object.
So is there any evidence that anyone saw the firearm or the BB gun during the robbery?
In the light most favorable to the Commonwealth, I'm not sure that I can argue that the victim was not unequivocal in his testimony. And he was, the co-defendant did say, so I guess I'm going to walk that back now, apologize. The co-defendant did say that it was at the robbery, but...
But did he say it was visible, that someone saw it, or all we know it's still in his pocket, right?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that is the record.
Well, didn't Johnson say Daryl had the gun saying, give me the money?
PA 197, but he doesn't say where he had the gun, does he?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe that is the testimony.
Was that 197?
Daryl had the gun saying, give me money, and then he talks about, he doesn't say if he saw really saw the gun until he does 198, where he talks about him possessing it at the home and him seeing it there. But.
So he doesn't say anything about it being brandished in any way?
Do you, certainly, Your Honor, because the Commonwealth does ask, do you remember which hand he had the gun in? And he says, not really. In the light most favorable of the Commonwealth, that could suggest that he had it in a hand, but I would submit that the record is unclear whether or not he was brandishing the firearm, and again, the victim thought that he had something in his hand, but again, was unclear what he saw or what he was hit in the head with.
I'm sure you understand we're trying to get to the boundaries.
Certainly.
And that's why, that's the purpose of hypothetical questions. Under 308.2, the phraseology is designed, made, and intended to fire or expel a projectile by means of an explosion. Would that be sufficient to cover an object, a weapon, a firearm, that is so rusty it does not operate that way now?
Are you asking if it doesn't operate that way? If it was originally designed, intended to...
Designed, made, and intended to fire or expel a projectile by means of an explosion. If you had a weapon that clearly met that test, but is not currently capable of being operated that way because it's so rusty or a pin is missing or something of that nature, does it nonetheless suffice under 18.2.308.2? And does it suffice under 18.2.53.1?
Certainly it suffices under 308.2, and I believe Armstrong even says that it does not have to be currently operational or functional. It just needs to be an instrument that was originally designed or intended to expel.
What about 18.2.53.1? Does it suffice under that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Both of them?
I believe so.
All right.
I believe that that case law does support that. And again, the director would submit that this case, the Commonwealth put forth sufficient evidence to survive the motion to strike, and at the time the trial court would have weighed the motion to strike, it would needed to take full faith and credit to the witnesses that have testified and weigh the evidence in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth, drawing all inferences from the testimony. And the director would submit that all inferences from the testimony and giving full faith and credit to the three witnesses that testified would have made the trial court not grant the motion to strike if it had been granted. Or, I'm sorry, if it had been made.
Under Strickland, though, do you need to go that far? I mean, we're not talking about a sufficiency analysis on direct appeal. We're talking about a habeas. And ineffective assistance of counsel doesn't apply where the law is unclear or ambiguous or has not been settled. And here we are. We've asked excellent boundary line questions, at least speaking only for myself. I can't tell you where the boundary is. I've read all the cases you all have read. And I'm wondering if the point you're trying to make is really stronger than the point you need to make, similar to actually the appellant, or the petitioner, rather.
Certainly, Your Honor. And I think I do a better job going into this in my brief, in that based on the totality of this record, the trial court in this case wouldn't have granted a motion to strike.
Well, my point is we don't know, because until this opinion is issued, we're not going to exactly know what the rule of law is on this kind of scenario where someone puts a weapon that's identified as a weapon in his belt. He tells him, I'm going to hit a lick, which is slang for robbery or something bad. He goes and he has it with him, according to another witness, during the robbery. I don't know that we've ever held flat out that that's not enough on the 308.2.
I would agree, Your Honor. And again, under the Strickland analysis and in an effective claim, the probability of a different outcome has to be not just conceivable, but it has to be a reasonable probability.
Well, and I take it his question was directed at the ineffective prong, and you can win on either. So it may be that, for instance, a vigorous cross-examination would have been fruitful, but counsel tactically decided that you know, making the victim weep on the stand and so on would be inexpedient, and so that was a tactical decision. So the fact that the prejudice is on one side, if the ineffective assistance prong is on the other, the petitioner has to show both. That's where I understood the question.
Certainly, the burden is on the petitioner to show both sufficient performance and prejudice. And in this case, it was also objectively reasonable. Trial counsel had a defense. He was attempting to get the defendant off, get an acquittal on all the charges that he faced. He was facing significant sentencing exposure on the other three felonies. He argued to the jury that there was no gun at all present, that they were just pinning it on his client because they were giving favorable deals to liars, essentially.
Let me ask you a question. What does that have to do with them asking for a motion to strike in the second segment of the trial?
I think there's multiple points to answering that question. First, the fact that the jury instruction went to the jury in the first trial under the definition of 308.2, I think it was objectively reasonable. He thought that the jury may have already decided that factual issue against his client. And therefore, a motion to strike wouldn't have been granted. And also, the trial court knew what the jury was instructed in the first portion of the trial. So I also think the director would submit that it's unusual for, at least personally, I haven't seen a lot of these charges charged like this with the same jury back to back. And I think that the trial counsel also objectively, reasonably was trying to remain credible in front of the jury.
But remember, the motion to strike is not going to be argued necessarily in front of the jury.
True, Your Honor, and I apologize. But I think the petitioner is not entitled to a perfect trial, but he is entitled to a trial where this trial counsel had a theory defense, did move to strike. The Court of Appeals has found that he missed this discrete issue, but I would submit that he, based on the totality of the record, that the petitioner has failed to show there was deficient performance, as indicated by the gray area of the law of this case, of the facts of this case, and that the Commonwealth made a prima facie case for that charge, and therefore, again, the motion to strike would not have been granted, even if he made it on the very specific issue of it before this court. Unless the court has any further questions, the director would submit that the petitioner has failed to meet his burden under the Strickland test, and we would ask that you dismiss the habeas petition. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You do have rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honor. This discrete issue at the time of Darrell's trial in 2015 had ample case law on point. This court had repeatedly distinguished between the types of instruments that qualify as a 53.1 use firearm and a 308.2 possession firearm.
But Jordan is your best case, right?
Jordan and Armstrong, yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, Jordan is not our case. So the question I'm I'll ask you, we're not on direct appeal on sufficiency. We're in Strickland land. And so if the law is unclear until we say it's clear in this opinion or order or whatever, Strickland, generally speaking, backs off. Because when the law is unclear, we don't make new law through habeas. We make new law through direct appeals, right? So if Jordan's your best case, and we have a factual scenario that's sort of close, I'll give you the benefit of the doubt, it's really sort of close, but not on point. Should we issue a habeas writ, or should we say, wait for this to come up on direct appeal, because lawyers are not required to predict where the law is going to go. They're required to deal with it as it exists.
Your Honor, you should issue the writ. And the reason why is the habeas standard is not, is there a 100% certainty that the motion to strike in this case would have been granted? It is there a reasonable probability? And I am not aware of any habeas case law that says there needs to be direct factual cases directly on point with the facts of the current criminal case. What we have here is we have Jordan, but we also have Armstrong, when defining 308.2 possession firearm, said element is no perception, excuse me, perception is no element of that charge. And under those two cases, I understand Your Honor's point about the witnesses' unfamiliarity with the specific instrument at issue, which counsels in favor of granting the motion to strike a reasonable probability, but also there was none of that additional evidence that has been present on all the other cases. So for those reasons, we posit that there's a reasonable probability that the motion to strike would have been granted and request that all habeas relief is afforded. Thank you for your time.
Mr. Gunn, at this price this morning, when we introduced, we had the introduction of lawyers to the Virginia State Bar, I made the point of telling them all how much the court is in favor of and supportive of pro bono activities. And I want to thank both of you for doing your part. I know you and your firm do it on a regular basis, as other law firms do, but we ask you to do this, and we appreciate your performance.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Call the next case. Are we through? We're through. Recess until 11 o'clock.
All right. I know.